Was it taxes and political theory that drove the men and women of the colonies to strike out with physical protest? And how did the outrage that began in the villages of America develop into a movement led by the founding fathers and then to the government the United States has today? Tim Breen offers some answers through a populist history of the American Revolution in his new book, American Insurgents, American Patriots, The Revolution of the People. He's a professor of American history at Northwestern University, and he joins us now. Tim Breen, welcome to Radio Boston.
I'm really glad to be on your show.
Well, Tim Breen, we just finished another Independence Day, but you actually say that it's April 19th, 1775, of course, the day the shot heard around the world was fired at Lexington and Concord. You say that day is just as important, if not more so, than the 4th of July.
Oftentimes, historians start the run-up to the Revolution as early as 1763. And so the model might be like a pressure cooker and it slowly builds steam. But in point of fact, ordinary Americans, the ones that actually fought at Bunker Hill, were drawn into the revolutionary movement during the summer of 1774. And through a series of actions, they drove British authorities out of the countryside. They were angry and they were roused, but when the British came and shot down farmers in the Lexington Commons and then tried to burn Concord, the reaction of the ordinary folks throughout America, not just New England, was electric. There was no turning back at that point. The ordinary people, pretty much at that point, were on board for systematic, organized, armed resistance to British power. And that's why I say it was the turning point in our nation's history.
You've titled your book American Insurgents, American Patriots, and of course in this day and age that word insurgents probably carries some negative connotations given current wars the United States is involved in. So why is it that you've put that word American Insurgent in your title?
Well, it sounds like it was a marketing ploy to get people aroused and provoked, but in fact the word was used at the time of our American Revolution. I felt ordinary readers today needed to be reminded that at the beginning of our political culture, we too were insurgents. We may find them objectionable today in other places, but once they were us. And if you were General Gage in Boston looking out at the Massachusetts countryside, I think you would have had no doubt that those folks earned that title.
And in fact, you write that in 1774, when you're referring to General Gage looking out at the rest of Massachusetts, that he felt fairly secure in Boston with his some 3,000 redcoats. But beyond the borders of Boston, everywhere else, he was staring down a group of average men and women who were deeply unhappy with the situation, which is why I find your book so fascinating, because the founding fathers, those regular cast of characters that we all learn about in school, they do make an appearance. But you say that those gentlemen were, in fact, quote, the beneficiaries of rebellious insurgents who initially sparked the resistance. Why is it that these people, this sort of average person, is the one you decided to focus on in the book?
There is a kind of a default interpretation of the American Revolution. I'm sure you learned it in school. I certainly did. And there's nothing objectionable about it. It turns on the works of about five or six or seven extraordinary gentlemen. They're well-read. They're enlightened people. They do good things. And our story is of the Revolution is told around these people, Washington, Madison, Adams. There's nothing wrong with that, except it leaves out the great majority of ordinary men and women who actually did the heavy lifting of revolution. And the purpose of my book is not to erase the founding fathers, but to remind modern Americans that without these ordinary people, there would be no revolution, no independence, indeed no constitution. They were absolutely central, and they were fully mobilized by September of 1774, and a year and a half before the founding fathers got around to declaring independence, British authority outside of Boston was completely removed through a series of insurgent acts, of terrorizing officials, to using violence against British troops. These farm families made their political will absolutely clear to the British Empire, and more important, and I think in answering your question, they made it clear to their leaders who came very close to becoming followers.
Why don't you tell us about some of these ordinary farm families that you've researched and talk about so wonderfully in the book. I mean, there's John Patton, for example.
The Patton family in Bedford, New Hampshire, they've left a beautiful diary of a hardscrabble Scots-Irish Presbyterian family as they're drawn step by step into using violence as a revolutionary tool against an oppressive colonial power. Look, no one welcomes being killed. No one welcomes violence. The process comes in little steps. You sign a petition, you send money, you do a lot of things before you finally take up violence. And the Patton family, you can see it in their diaries step by step until finally, after Concord and Lexington, their son rushes from New Hampshire to Bunker Hill where he's severely wounded. He goes back to New Hampshire, he recovers, and then he re-enlists, and he's killed in late 1775, early 1776. And, you know, he have a grieving family whose son has died for a country that doesn't exist yet. In fact, the only thing that they can cling to is something called the American cause.
You quote from Matthew Patton, John's father's diary. He was shot through his left arm at Bunker Hill fight and now was led after suffering much fatigue to the place where he now lies in defending the rights of America, to whose end he came in the prime of his life by means of that wicked, tyrannical brute, nay, worse than brute, of Great Britain. He was 24 years and 31 days old. And it's that kind of visceral, passionate language that you've uncovered in the diaries and correspondence of these average farmers, as you say, that really figures centrally into why you think these American insurgents were so successful. Can you tell us a bit more about that, about the visceral nature of what they were doing and what they were feeling?
You're absolutely right on about what I wanted to achieve, because our standard understanding of the Revolution is so reasonable, so rational. You have to inject into the mix passions, emotions, hatred, fear, anger, a sense of betrayal, a desire for revenge. These are things that I think unsettle modern Americans. But unless you have that passionate drive, all the high ideas about liberty and freedom don't take you very far. You need both. You need a sense of what a country or a cause can become, but you also need to figure out how you're going to get John Patton onto a battlefield and risk getting shot.
You say that religion, and particularly evangelical preachers, played quite a significant role in organizing these sort of average Americans and also building a sense of cohesion between the colonies as well.
These were children of something called the Great Awakening, which was an evangelical movement that swept the colonies in the middle of the 18th century. And the people that stormed Bunker Hill and reacted to Lexington and Concord so viscerally believed that the Lord gave them a certain set of rights. But rights come with responsibilities. And if an oppressive government, a despotic government, rides over your rights and you stand passive, then you're insulting not only your good sense but the Lord. And so they felt duty-bound to rise up and to defend what they felt was a set of rights that had been betrayed by the British government. And I hasten to quickly say, we're not talking in a gross or sense about taxes. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes people say, oh, well, they don't like to pay taxes. That's a cause for rebellion. This is not what these people did. They said it was taxes without representation. And in fact, even in the darkest days in Massachusetts, they sent their tax money to the provisional government. And they were not complaining about that. They were complaining about a government that does not have listened to their voice.
You note that Reverend Nathan Fisk, he was a respected minister in Brookfield, Massachusetts. You know, as early as 1774, he explained to his congregation that when people oppose the authority of their rulers, it is generally called insurrection and rebellion. And when a mob assumes government into their own hands, they are in danger of committing such violence and outrage as are many degrees beyond the guilt and mischief of bare opposition. So how is it then that this movement didn't end up disintegrating into mob rule, and leadership of a form was handed over to the founding fathers that we all know of?
It's a very important issue, because they did, in fact, even in the worst of times, maintain a kind of structure of law. I think one reason is that they were aware that if they went too far, they would only encourage royalists and drive people that were moderate into permanent opposition. There was need for assuring people that they, in fact, weren't going to be killed and so on. But more, in the fall of 1774, the First Continental Congress passed a document that none of us learned about in school and has an unlikely name called the Association. And by the Association, every town, county, city, hamlet in America was asked to form a committee. And thousands of men who had never been in politics before because of class or background or education flooded into this new revolutionary insurgent government. And these people generally followed what you and I would recognize as a rule of law. I don't want to push it too far. If you were a Tory, you perhaps were not allowed free speech or freedom of press, but they avoided some of the excesses of violence and bloodshed that plagued other revolutions.
Many of us have never really been given such a wonderful treatment of the American Revolution from the average person's perspective at that time. So why is it, do you think, that this history isn't as popularly known or learned about as the conventional one of the Founding Fathers?
Well, I think one reason is that our revolution, as long as it's seen as a rational and very special Founding Fathers, separates our revolution from other revolutions that got out of hand, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, even more modern colonial rebellions against imperial authority. I'm trying to remind the American people that, in fact, our rebellion is in a tradition of ordinary people seeking liberty, freedom, equality, justice in a political forum. And to treat our revolution as an exceptional moment cuts off that kind of comparative vision of ourselves with other people in other places seeking justice.
Well, Timothy Breen, author of American Insurgents, American Patriots, The Revolution of the People, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Boston.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, you expect to see an orchestra performing at Symphony Hall, but how about on the MBTA? The Landmarks Orchestra brings traditional classical music to non-traditional Boston spaces. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.